You bet I'm gonna leave. Because that was a dirty cheat. That wasn't what happened last week.
She looked at him, and Paul saw clear murder in her eyes.
He didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle car. It went over the edge, and he was still inside it. Do you understand that?
Yes, Paul said.
Do you understand that?
She suddenly leaped at him with that limber ferocity, and although he felt certain she meant to hurt him as she had before, possibly because she couldn't get at the dirty birdie of a scriptwriter who had cheated Rocket Man out of the Hudson before it went over the cliff, he did not move at all. He could see the seeds of her current instability in the window of past she had just opened for him, but he was also awed by it. The injustice she felt was, in spite of its childishness, completely, inarguably real. She didn't hit him. She seized the front of the robe he was wearing and dragged him forward until their faces were nearly touching.
Do you?
Yes, Annie, yes. She stared at him, that furious black gaze, and must have seen the truth in his face, because after a moment she slung him contemptuously back in the chair. He grimaced against the thick, grinding pain, and after a while it began to subside.
Then you know what is wrong, she said.
I suppose I do. Although I'll be goddamned if I know how I'm going to fix it. And that other voice returned at once. I don't know if you'll be damned by God or saved by him, Polly. But one thing I do know. If you don't find a way to bring Misery back to life, a way she can believe, she's going to kill you.
Then do it.
She said curtly, and left the room. Paul looked at the typewriter. The typewriter was there. Ends. He had never realized how many ends there were in an average line of type.
I thought you were supposed to be good, the typewriter said.
His mind had invested it with a sneering and yet callow voice. The voice of a teenage gunslinger in a Hollywood Western, a kid intent on making a fast reputation here in Deadwood. You're not so good, hell. You can't even please one crazy overweight nurse. Maybe you broke your writing bone in that crash, too. Only that bone isn't healing. He leaned back as far as the wheelchair would allow and closed his eyes. Her rejection of what he had written would be easier to bear if he could blame it on the pain, but the truth was that the pain had finally begun to subside a little. The stolen pills were safely tucked away between the mattress and the box spring. He had taken none of them. Knowing he had put them aside, a form of Annie insurance, was enough. She would find them if she took it into her head to turn the mattress, he supposed, but that was a chance he was prepared to take. There had been no trouble between them since the blow-up over the typewriter paper. His medication came regularly, and he took it. He wondered if she knew he was hooked on the stuff.
Hey, come on now, Paul. That's a bit of a dramatization, isn't it?
No, it wasn't. 3 nights ago, when he was sure she was upstairs, he had sneaked one of the sample boxes out and had read everything on the label, although he supposed he had read everything he needed when he saw what Novril's principal ingredient was. Maybe you spelled relief, R-O-L-A-I-D-S, but you spelled Novril, C-O-D-E-I-N-E. The fact is, you're healing up, Paul. Below the knees, your legs look like a 4-year-old stick drawing, but you are healing up. You could get by on aspirin or Imprin now. It's not you that needs the Novril. You're feeding it to the monkey. He would have to cut down, have to duck some of the caps. Until he could do that, she would have him on a chain as well as in a wheelchair. A chain of Novril capsules. Okay. I'll duck one of the 2 capsules she gives me every other time she brings them. I'll put it under my tongue when I swallow the other one, and stick it under my mattress with the other pills when she takes the drinking glass out. Only not today. I don't feel ready to start today. I'll start tomorrow. Now in his mind he heard the voice of the Red Queen lecturing Alice. Down here we got our act clean yesterday, and we plan to start getting our act clean tomorrow. But we never clean up our act. Today.
Oh-ho, Polly, you're a real riot, the typewriter said in the tough Gunsel's voice he had made up for it. Us dirty birdies are never all that funny, but we never stop trying. You have to give us that, he muttered. Well, you better start thinking about all the dope you're taking, Paul. You better start thinking about it very seriously.
He decided suddenly on the spur of the moment that he would start dodging some of the medication as soon as he got a first chapter that Annie liked on paper, a chapter which Annie decided wasn't a cheat. Part of him, the part that listened to even the best, fairest editorial suggestions with ill grace, protested that the woman was crazy, that there was no way to tell what she might or might not accept, that anything he tried would only be a crapshoot. But another part, a far more sensible part, disagreed. He would know the real stuff when he found it. The real stuff would make the crap he had given Annie to read last night, the crap it had taken him 3 days and false starts without number to write, look like a dog turd sitting next to a silver dollar. Hadn't he known it was all wrong? It wasn't like him to labor so painfully, nor to half fill a wastebasket with random jottings or half pages, which ended in lines like, "Misery turned to him, eyes shining, lips murmuring the magic words, 'Oh, you numb shithead, this isn't working at all.'" He had chalked it off to the pain and to being in a situation where he was not just writing for his supper, but for his life. Those ideas had been nothing but plausible lies. The fact was, things had gone dry. The work had gone badly because he was cheating, and he had known it himself. "Well, she saw through you, shit for brains," the typewriter said in its nasty, insolent voice. "Didn't she? So what are you going to do now?" He didn't know, but he supposed he would have to do something, and in a hurry. He hadn't cared for her mood this morning. He supposed he should count himself lucky that she hadn't rebroken his legs with a baseball bat or given him a battery acid manicure, something similar to indicate her displeasure with the way he'd begun her book. Such critical responses were always possible, given Annie's unique view of the world. If he got out of this alive, he thought he might drop Christopher Hale a note. Hale reviewed books for the New York Times. The note would say, "Whenever my editor called me up and told me you were planning to review one of my books in the Daily Times, my knees used to knock together. You gave me some good ones, Chris, old buddy, but you also torpedoed me more than once, as you well know. Anyway, I just wanted to tell you to go ahead and do your worst. I've discovered a whole new critical mode, my friend. We might call it the Colorado Barbecue and Floor Bucket School of Thought. It makes the stuff you guys do look about as scary as a ride on the Central Park carousel. This is all very amusing, Paul. Writing critics little B.A. do in one's head is always good for a giggle. But you really ought to find yourself a pot and get it boiling, don't you think?" "Yes. Yes, indeed." The typewriter sat there, smirking at him. "I hate you," Paul said morosely, and looked out the window. The snowstorm to which Paul had awakened the day after his expedition to the bathroom had gone on for 2 days. There had been at least 18 inches of new fall and heavy drifting. By the time the sun finally peered through the clouds again, Annie's Cherokee was nothing but a vague hump in the driveway. Now, however, the sun was out again, and the sky was brilliant once more. That sun had heat as well as brilliance. He could feel it on his face and hands as he sat there. The icicles along the barn were dripping again. He thought briefly of his car in the snow, and then picked up a piece of paper and rolled it into the Royal. He typed the words "Misery's Return" in the upper left-hand corner, the number 1 in the upper right. He banged the carriage return lever 4 or 5 times, centered the carriage, and typed Chapter 1. He hit the keys harder than necessary, so she would be sure to hear he was typing something at least. Now there was all this white space below Chapter 1, looking like a snowbank into which he could fall and die, smothered in frost. Africa. As long as they played fair. That bird came from Africa. There was a parachute under his seat. Africa. Now I must rinse. He was drifting off and knew he shouldn't. If she came in here and caught him cooping instead of writing, she would be mad. but he let himself drift away. He was not just dozing. He was, in an odd way, thinking, looking, searching. Searching for what, Polly? But that was obvious. The plane was in a power dive. He was searching for the parachute under the seat. Okay, fair enough? Fair enough. When he found the parachute under the seat, it was fair. Maybe not all that realistic, but fair. For a couple of summers, his mother had sent him to a day camp at the Malden Community Center. And they had played this game. They sat in a circle, and the game was like Annie's chapter plays. And he almost always won. What was that game called? He could see 15 or 20 little boys and girls sitting in a circle in one shady corner of a playground, all of them wearing Malden Community Center T-shirts, all listening intently as the counselor explained how the game was played. Can You. The name of that game was Can You. And it really was just like the Republic cliffhangers. The game you played then was Can You, Polly. And that's the name of the game now, isn't it? Yes. He supposed it was. In Can You, the counselor would start a story about this guy named Careless Corrigan. Careless was lost in the trackless jungles of South America. Suddenly he looks around and sees there are lions behind him. Lions on either side of him. And by God, lions ahead of him. Careless Corrigan is surrounded by lions. And they're starting to move in. It's only 5 in the afternoon, but that is no problem for these kiddies. As far as South American lions are concerned, that dinner at 8 shit is for goofballs. The counselor had had a stopwatch, and Paul Sheldon's dozing mind saw it with brilliant clarity, although he had last held its honest silver weight in his hand more than 30 years ago. He could see the fine copper plate of the numbers, the smaller needle at the bottom which recorded tenths of seconds. He could see the brand name printed in tiny letters. Annex. The counselor would look around the circle and pick one of the day campers. Daniel, he would say. Can you? The moment Can You was out of his mouth, the counselor would click the stopwatch into motion. Daniel then had exactly 10 seconds to go on with the story. If he did not begin to speak during those 10 seconds, he had to leave the circle. But if he got careless away from the lions, the counselor would look at the circle again and ask the game's other question, one that recalled his current situation clearly to mind again. This question was, did he? The rules for this part of the game were Annie's exactly. Realism was not necessary. Fairness was. Daniel could say, for instance, luckily, Careless had his Winchester with him and plenty of ammo, so he shot 3 of the lions and the rest ran away. In a case like that, Daniel did. He got the stopwatch and went on with the story, ending his segment with Careless up to his hips in a pool of quicksand or something. And then he would ask someone else if he or she could, and bang down the button on the stopwatch. But 10 seconds wasn't long, and it was easy to get jammed up, easy to cheat. The next kid might well say something like, "Just then this great big bird, an Andean vulture, I think, flew down. Careless grabbed its neck and made it pull him out of that quicksand." When the counselor asked, "Did she?" you raised your hand if you thought she had, left it down if you thought she had blown it. In the case of the Andean vulture, the kid would almost surely have been invited to leave the circle. Can you, Paul? Yeah. That's how I survive. That's how come I'm able to maintain homes in both New York and L.A., and more rolling iron than there is in some used car lots. Because I can. And it's not something to apologize for, goddammit. There are lots of guys out there who write a better prose line than I do, and who have a better understanding of what people are really like, and what humanity is supposed to mean. Hell, I know that. When the counselor asks did he about those guys, sometimes only a few people raise their hands. But they raise their hands for me. Or for misery. And in the end, I guess they're both the same. Can I? Yeah. You bet I can. There's a million things in this world I can't do. Couldn't hit a curveball even back in high school. Can't fix a leaky faucet. Can't roller skate or make an F chord on the guitar that sounds like anything but shit. I've tried twice to be married and couldn't do it either time. But if you want me to take you away, to scare you or involve you or make you cry or grin, yeah, I can. I can bring it to you and keep bringing it to you until you holler, Uncle. I am able. I can. The typewriter's insolent gunslinger voice whispered into this deepening dream. What we got here, friends, is a lot of two things. Big talk and white space. Can you? Yes. Yes. Did he? No. He cheated. In Misery's Child, the doctor never came. Maybe the rest of you forgot what happened last week, but the stone idol never forgets. Paul has to leave the circle. Pardon me, please. Now I must rinse. Now I must... rinse, he muttered, and slid over to the right. This dragged his left leg slightly askew, and the bolt of pain in his crushed knee was enough to wake him up. Less than 5 minutes had gone by. He could hear Annie washing dishes in the kitchen. Usually she sang as she did her chores. Today she was not singing. There was only the rattle of plates and the occasional hiss of rinse water. Another bad sign. Here's a special weather bulletin for residents of Sheldon County. A tornado watch is in effect until 5 p.m. tonight. I repeat, a tornado watch. But it was time to stop playing games and get down to business. She wanted Misery back from the dead, but it had to be fair. Not necessarily realistic, just fair. If he could do it this morning, he could just maybe, he could just derail the depression he sensed coming on before it could get a real start. Paul looked out the window, his chin on his palm. He was fully awake now, thinking fast and hard, but not really aware of the process. The top two or three layers of his conscious mind, which dealt with such things as when he had last shampooed, or whether or not Annie would be on time with his next dope allotment, seemed to have departed the scene entirely. That part of his head had quietly gone out to get up a Stramion rye or something. There was sensory input, but he was not doing anything with it, not seeing what he was seeing, not hearing what he was hearing. Another part of him was furiously trying out ideas, rejecting them, trying to combine them, rejecting the combinations. He sensed this going on, but had no direct contact with it and wanted none. It was dirty down there in the sweatshops. He understood what he was doing now as trying to have an idea. Trying to have an idea wasn't the same as getting an idea. Getting an idea was a more humble way of saying, I am inspired, or Eureka, my muse has spoken. The idea for fast cars had come to him one day in New York City. He had gone out with no more in mind than buying a VCR for the townhouse on 83rd Street. He had passed a parking lot and had seen an attendant trying to jimmy his way into a car. That was all. He had no idea if what he had seen was licit or illicit. And by the time he had walked another two or three blocks, he no longer cared. The attendant had become Tony Bonassaro. He knew everything about Tony but his name, which he later plucked from a telephone book. Half the story existed full-blown in his mind, and the rest was rapidly falling into place. He felt jivey, happy, almost drunk. The muse had arrived, every bit as welcome as an unexpected check in the mail. He had set out to get a video recorder and had gotten something much better instead. He had gotten an idea. This other process, trying to have an idea, was nowhere near as exalted or exalting, but it was every bit as mysterious, and every bit as necessary. Because when you were writing a novel, you almost always got roadblocked somewhere, and there was no sense in trying to go on until you had an idea. His usual procedure, when it was necessary to have an idea, was to put on his coat and go for a walk. If he didn't need to have an idea, he took a book when he went for a walk. He recognized walking as good exercise, but it was boring. If you didn't have someone to talk to while you walked, a book was a necessity. But if you needed to have an idea, boredom could be to a roadblocked novel what chemotherapy was to a cancer patient. Halfway through Fast Cars, Tony had killed Lieutenant Gray when the lieutenant tried to slap the cuffs on him in a Times Square movie theater. Paul wanted Tony to get away with a murder, for a while anyway, because there could be no third act with Tony sitting in the cooler. Yet Tony could not simply leave Gray sitting in a movie theater with a haft of a knife sticking out of his left armpit, because there were at least three people who knew Gray had gone to meet Tony. Body disposal was the problem, and Paul didn't know how to solve it. It was a roadblock. It was the game. It was careless, just kill this guy in a Times Square movie theater. Now he's got to get the body back to his car without anyone saying, "Hey, mister, is that guy as dead as he looks, or did he just pitch a fit or something?" If he gets Gray's corpse back to the car, he can drive it to Queens and dump it in this abandoned building project he knows about. Polly, can you? There was no 10-second deadline, of course. He'd had no contract for the book, had written it on spec, and hence there was no delivery date to think about. Yet there was always a deadline, a time after which you had to leave the circle, and most writers knew it. If a book remained roadblocked long enough, it began to decay, to fall apart. All the little tricks and illusions started to show. He had gone for a walk, thinking of nothing on top of his mind, the way he was thinking of nothing on top right now. He had walked 3 miles before someone set up a flare from the sweatshops down below. Suppose he starts a fire in a theater. That looked like it might work. There was no sense of giddiness, no true feeling of inspiration. He felt like a carpenter looking at a piece of lumber that might do the job. He could set a fire in the stuffing of a seat next to him. How's that? Goddamn seats in those theaters were always torn up. There'd be smoke, lots of it. He could hold off leaving as long as possible, then drag Gray out with him. He can pass Gray off as a smoke inhalation victim. What do you think? He had thought it was okay. Not great, and there were plenty of details still to be worked out, but it looked okay. He'd had an idea. The work could proceed. He'd never needed to have an idea to start a book, but he understood instinctively that it could be done. He sat quietly on the chair, chin on hand, looking out at the barn. If he'd been able to walk, he would have been out there in the field. He sat quietly, almost dozing, waiting for something to happen, really aware of nothing at all except that things were happening down below, that whole edifices of make-believe were being erected, judged, found wanting, and torn down again in the wink of an eye. 10 minutes passed. 15. Now she was running the vacuum cleaner in the parlor, but still not singing. He heard it, but did nothing with the hearing of it. It was unconnected sound which ran into his head and then out again like water running through a flume. Finally the guys down below shot up a flare as they always eventually did. Poor buggers down there never stopped busting their balls, and he didn't envy them one little bit. Paul sat quietly, beginning to have an idea. His conscious mind returned. The doctor is in. And picked the idea up like a letter pushed through the mail slot in a door. He began to examine it. He almost rejected it. Was that a faint groan from down there in the sweatshops? Reconsidered. Decided half of it could be saved. A second flare. This one brighter than the first. Paul began to drum his fingers restlessly on the windowsill. Around 11 o'clock he began to type. This went very slowly at first. Individual clacks followed by spaces of silence, some as long as 15 seconds. It was the oral equivalent of an island archipelago seen from the air, a chain of low humps broken by broad swaths of blue. Little by little the spaces of silence began to shorten, and now there were occasional bursts of typing. It would have sounded fine on Paul's electric typewriter, but the clacking sound of the Royal was thick, actively unpleasant. But Paul did not notice the Ducky Daddle's voice of the typewriter. He was warming up by the bottom of the first page. By the bottom of the second, he was in high gear. After a while, Annie turned off the vacuum cleaner and stood in the doorway watching him. Paul had no idea she was there, had no idea, in fact, that he was. He had finally escaped. He was in Little Dunthorpe's churchyard, breathing damp night air, smelling moss and earth and mist. He heard the clock in the tower of the Presbyterian Church strike 2, and dumped it into the story without missing a beat. When it was very good, he could see through the paper. He could see through it now. Annie watched him for a long time, her heavy face unsmiling, moveless, but somehow satisfied. After a while, she went away. Her tread was heavy, but Paul didn't hear that either. He worked until 3 o'clock that afternoon, and at 8 that night he asked her to help him back into the wheelchair again. He wrote another 3 hours, although by 10 o'clock the pain had begun to be quite bad. Annie came in at 11. He asked for another 15 minutes. "No, Paul, it's enough. You're white as salt." She got him into bed, and he was asleep in 3 minutes. He slept the whole night through for the first time since coming out of the gray cloud, and his sleep was for the first time utterly without dreams. He had been dreaming awake. Misery's Return by Paul Sheldon for Annie Wilkes. Chapter 1. For a moment, Jeffrey Aliburton was not sure who the old man at the door was, and this was not entirely because the bell had awakened him from a deepening doze. The irritating thing about village life, he thought, was that there weren't enough people for there to be any perfect strangers. Instead, there were just enough to keep one from knowing immediately who many of the villagers were. Sometimes all one really had to go on was a family resemblance, and such resemblances, of course, never precluded the unlikely but hardly impossible coincidence of bastardy. One could usually handle such moments, no matter how much one might feel one was entering one's dotage, while trying to maintain an ordinary conversation with a person whose name one should be able to recall but could not. Things only reached the more cosmic realms of embarrassment when two such familiar faces arrived at the same time, and one felt called upon to make introductions.
"I hope I'll not be disturbing you, sir," this visitor said.
He was twisting a cheap cloth cap restlessly in his hands, and in the light cast by the lamp Jeffrey held up, his face looked lined and yellow, and terribly worried, frightened even.
"It's just that I didn't want to go to Dr. Booking's, nor did I want to disturb his lordship. Not at least until I'd spoken to you, if you take my meaning, sir."
Jeffrey didn't, but quite suddenly he did know one thing, who this late-coming visitor was. The mention of Dr. Bookings, the C of E minister, had done it. 3 days ago, Dr. Bookings had performed Misery's few last rites in the churchyard which lay behind the rectory, and this fellow had been there, but lurking considerately in the background, where he was less apt to be noticed. His name was Coulter. He was one of the church sextons. To be brutally frank, the man was a gravedigger.
"Coulter," he said, "what can I do for you?"
Coulter spoke hesitantly.
"It's the noises, sir. The noises in the churchyard. Her ladyship rests not easy, sir, so she doesn't, and I'm afeard. I—"
Jeffrey felt as if someone had punched him in the midsection. He pulled in a gasp of air, and hot pain needled his side, where his ribs had been tightly taped by Dr. Shinebone. Shinebone's gloomy assessment had been that Jeffrey would almost certainly take pneumonia after lying in that ditch all night in the chilly rain. But 3 days had passed, and there had been no onset of fever and coughing. He had known there would not be. God did not let off the guilty so easily. He believed that God would let him live, to perpetuate his poor lost darling's memory for a long, long time.
"Are you all right, sir?" Coulter asked. "I heard you were terrible bunged up t'other night." He paused. "The night herself died."
"I'm fine," Jeffrey said slowly. "Coulter, these sounds you say you hear, you know they're just imaginings, don't you?" Coulter looked shocked.
"Imaginings?" he asked. "Sir, next you'll be telling me you have no belief in Jesus and the life everlasting. Why didn't Duncan Frumsley see old man Patterson not 2 days after his funeral, glowing just as white as marsh fire?"
Which was just what it probably was, Jeffrey thought. Marsh fire plus whatever came out of old Frumsley's last bottle.
"And ain't half the bleeding town seen that old papist monk that walks the battlements of Ridgeheath Manor? They even sent down a couple of ladies from the Bleeding London Psychic Society to look into that one.
Geoffrey knew the ladies Coulter meant. A couple of hysterical beldames, probably suffering from the alternate calms and monsoons of midlife, both as dotty as a child's draw-it-name-it puzzle.
"Ghosts are just as real as you or me, sir," Coulter was saying earnestly. "I don't mind the idea of them. But these noises are fearsome spooky, so they are, and I hardly even like to go near the churchyard. And I have to dig a grave for the little Roydman babe tomorrow, so I do."
Geoffrey said an inward prayer for patience. The urge to bellow at this poor sexton was almost insurmountable. He had been dozing peacefully enough in front of his own fire with a book in his lap when Coulter came, waking him up. And he was coming more and more awake all the time, and at every second the dull sorrow settled more deeply over him, the awareness that his darling was gone. She was 3 days in her grave, soon to be a week, a month, a year, 10 years. The sorrow, he thought, was like a rock on the shoreline of the ocean. When one was sleeping, it was as if the tide was in, and there was some relief. Sleep was like a tide which covered the rock of grief. When one woke, however, the tide began to go out, and soon the rock was visible again, a barnacle-encrusted thing of inarguable reality, a thing which would be there forever, or until God chose to wash it away. And this fool dared to come here and prate of ghosts. But the man's face looked so wretched that Geoffrey was able to control himself. Miss Misery, her ladyship, was much loved, Geoffrey said quietly.
Aye, sir, so she was, Coulter agreed fervently.
He switched custody of his cloth cap to his left hand solely, and with his right produced a giant red handkerchief from his pocket. He honked mightily into it, his eyes watering.
All of us sorrow at her passing.
Geoffrey's hands went to his shirt and rubbed the heavy muslin wrappings beneath it restlessly.
Aye, so we do, sir. So we do.
Coulter's words were muffled in the handkerchief, but Geoffrey could see his eyes. The man was really, honestly weeping. The last of his own selfish anger dissolved in pity.
She were a good lady, sir. Aye, she were a great lady, and it's a terrible thing the way his lordship took on about it.
Aye, she was fine, Geoffrey said gently, and found to his dismay that his own tears were now close, like a cloudburst which threatens on a late summer's afternoon. And sometimes, Coulter, when someone especially fine passes away, someone especially dear to us all, we find it hard to let that someone go. So we may imagine that they have not gone. Do you follow me?
Aye, sir, Coulter said eagerly. But these sounds, sir, if you heard them.
Patiently, Geoffrey said, What sort of sounds do you mean? He thought Coulter would then speak of sounds which might be no more than the wind in the trees. Sounds amplified by his own imagination, of course. Or perhaps a badger bumbling its way down to Little Dunthorpe Stream, which lay behind the churchyard. And so he was hardly prepared when Coulter whispered in an affrighted voice,
Scratching sound, sir. It sounds as if she were still alive down there, and trying to work her way up back to the land of the living. So it does.
Chapter 2 15 minutes later, alone again, Geoffrey approached the dining-room sideboard. He was reeling from side to side like a man negotiating the foredeck of a ship in a gale. He felt like a man in a gale. He might have believed that the fever Dr. Shinebone had almost gleefully predicted had come on him at last, and with a vengeance. But it wasn't fever which had simultaneously brought wild red roses to his cheeks, and turned his forehead to the color of candle-wax. Not fever, which had made his hands shake so badly that he had almost dropped the decanter of brandy as he brought it out of the sideboard. If there was a chance, the slightest chance, that the monstrous idea Coulter had planted in his mind was true, then he had no business pausing here at all. but he felt that without a drink he might fall swooning to the floor. Jeffrey Aliburton did something then that he had never done before in his whole life, something he never did again. He lifted the decanter directly to his mouth and drank from the neck. Then he stepped back and whispered, "We shall see about this. We shall see about this, by heaven. And if I go on this insane errand, only to discover nothing at the end of it but an old gravedigger's imagination after all, I will have good man Coulter's earlobes on my watch-chain, no matter how much he loved misery." Chapter 3. He took the pony trap, driving under an eerie, not quite dark sky, where a three-quarters moon ducked restlessly in and out between the racing reefs of cloud. He had paused to throw on the first thing in the downstairs hall closet which came to hand. This turned out to be a dark maroon smoking jacket. The tails blew out behind him as he whipped Mary on. The elderly mare did not like the speed upon which he was insisting. Jeffrey did not like the deepening pain in his shoulder and side, but the pain of neither could be helped.
"Scratching sound, sir. It sounds as if she were still alive down there, and trying to work her way back up to the land of the living."
This by itself would not have put him in a state of near terror, but he remembered coming to Calthorpe Manor the day after Misery's death. He and Ian had looked at each other, and Ian had tried to smile, although his eyes were gem-like with unshed tears.
"It would somehow be easier," Ian had said, "if she looked more dead. I know that sounds..."
"Bosh," Jeffrey had said, trying to smile. "The undertaker doubtless exercised all his wit and..."
"Undertaker!"
Ian nearly screamed, and for the first time Jeffrey had truly understood that his friend was tottering on the brink of madness.
"Undertaker, ghoul! I've had no undertaker, and I will have no undertaker to come in and rouge my darling and paint her like a doll. Ian, my dear fellow, really you mustn't."
Jeffrey had made as if to clap Ian on the shoulder, and somehow that had turned into an embrace. The two men wept in each other's arms like tired children, while in some other room Misery's child, a boy now almost a day old and still unnamed, awoke and began to cry. Mrs. Ramage, whose own kindly heart was broken, began to sing it a cradle song in a voice cracked and full of tears. At the time, deeply afraid for Ian's sanity, he had been less concerned with what Ian said than how he had said it. Only now, as he whipped Mary ever faster toward little Dunthorpe, in spite of his own deepening pain, did the words come back, haunting in light of Coulter's tale. "If she looked more dead. If she looked more dead, old chap." Nor was that all. Late that afternoon, as the first of the village people had begun wending their way up Calthorpe Hill to pay their respects to the grieving lord, Shinebone had returned. He had looked tired, not very well himself, nor was this surprising in a man who claimed to have shaken hands with Wellington, the Iron Duke himself, when he, Shinebone, not Wellington, had been a boy. Jeffrey thought the Wellington story was probably an exaggeration, but old Shinny, as he and Ian had called him as boys, had seen Jeffrey through all his childhood illnesses, and Shinny had seemed a very old man to him, even then. Always granting the eye of childhood, which tends to see anyone over the age of 25 as elderly, he thought Shinny must be all of 75 now. He was old. He'd had a hectic, terrible last 24 hours. And might not an old, tired man have made a mistake? A terrible, unspeakable mistake? It was this thought, more than any other, which had sent him out on this cold and windy night, under a moon which stuttered uncertainly between the clouds. Could he have made such a mistake? Part of him, a craven, cowardly part, which would rather risk losing Misery forever than look upon the inevitable results of such a mistake, denied it. But when Shinny came in, Jeffrey had been sitting by Ian, who was remembering in a broken, scarcely coherent way how he and Ian had rescued Misery from the palace dungeons of the mad French Viscount LaRue, how they had escaped in a wagon load of hay, and how Misery distracted one of the Viscount's guards at a critical moment by slipping one gorgeously unclad leg out of the hay and waving it delicately. Geoffrey had been chiming in his own memories of the adventure, wholly in the grip of his grief by then, and he cursed that grief now, because to him and to Ian as well, he supposed, Shinny had barely been there. Hadn't Shinny seemed strangely distant, strangely preoccupied? Was it only weariness, or had it been something else, some suspicion? No, surely not. His mind protested uneasily. The pony trap was flying up Calthorpe Hill. The manor house itself was dark, but, oh, good, there was still a single light on in Mrs. Ramage's cottage. "Hook, Mary!" he cried, and cracked the whip, wincing. "Not much further, girl, and you can rest a bit." "Surely, surely not what you're thinking." But Shinny's examination of Geoffrey's broken ribs and sprained shoulder had seemed purely perfunctory, and he had spoken barely a word to Ian, in spite of the man's deep grief and frequent incoherent cries. No. After a visit which now seemed no longer than the most minimal sort of social convention would demand, Shinny had asked quietly, "Is she?" "Yes, in the parlor," Ian had managed. "My poor darling lies in the parlor. Kiss her for me, Shinny, and tell her I'll be with her soon." Ian had then burst into tears again, and after muttering some half-heard words of condolence, Shinny had passed into the parlor. It now seemed to Geoffrey that the old sawbones had been in there rather a long time, or perhaps that was only faulty recollection. But when he came out, he had looked almost cheerful, and there was nothing faulty about this recollection, Geoffrey felt sure. That expression was too out of place in that room of grief and tears, a room where Mrs. Ramage had already hung the black funerary curtains. Geoffrey had followed the old doctor out and spoke hesitantly to him in the kitchen. He hoped, he said, that the doctor would prescribe a sleeping powder for Ian, who really did seem quite ill. Shinny had seemed completely distracted, however. "It's not a bit like Miss Evelyn Hyde," he said. "I have satisfied myself of that." And he had returned to his calash without so much as a response to Geoffrey's question. Geoffrey went back inside, already forgetting the doctor's odd remark, already chalking Shinny's equally odd behavior off to age, weariness, and his own sort of grief. His thoughts had turned to Ian again, and he determined that with no sleeping powder forthcoming, he would simply have to pour whiskey down Ian's throat until the poor fellow passed out. Forgetting. Dismissing. Until now. "It's not a bit like Miss Evelyn Hyde. I have satisfied myself of that." Of what? Geoffrey did not know, but he intended to find out, no matter what the cost to his sanity might be, and he recognized that the cost might be high. Chapter 4. Mrs. Ramage was still up when Geoffrey began to hammer on the cottage door, although it was already 2 hours past her normal bedtime. Since misery had passed away, Mrs. Ramage found herself putting her bedtime further and further back. If she could not put an end to her restless tossing and turning, she could at least postpone the moment at which she began it. Although she was the most level-headed and practical of women, the sudden outburst of knocking startled a little scream from her, and she scalded herself with the hot milk she had been pouring from pot to cup. Lately she seemed always on edge, always on the verge of a scream. It was not grief, this feeling, although she was nearly overwhelmed with grief. This was a strange, thundery feeling that she couldn't ever remember having before. It sometimes seemed to her that thoughts better left unrecognized were circling around her, just beyond the grasp of her weary, bitterly sad mind. "Who knocks at 10? She cried at the door. "Whoever it is, I thank ye not for the burn I've given myself. It's Geoffrey, Mrs. Ramage. Geoffrey Aliburton, open the door, for God's sake!" Mrs. Ramage's mouth dropped open, and she was halfway to the door before she remembered she was in her nightgown and cap. She had never heard Geoffrey sound so, and would not have believed it if someone had told her of it. If there was a man in all England with a heart stouter than that of her beloved my lord, then it was Geoffrey. yet his voice trembled like the voice of a woman on the verge of hysterics.
"A minute, Mr. Jeffrey. I'm half unclad." "Devil take it," Jeffrey cried. "I don't care if you're stalkers, Mrs. Remmage. Open this door. Open it in the name of Jesus."
She stood only a second, then went to the door, unbarred it, and threw it open. Jeffrey's look did more than stun her, and again she heard the dim thunder of black thoughts somewhere back in her head. Jeffrey stood on the threshold of the housekeeper's cottage, in an odd slanting posture, as if his spine had been warped out of shape by long years carrying a peddler's sack. His right hand was pressed between his left arm and left side. His hair was in a tangle. His dark brown eyes burned out of his white face. His dress was remarkable for one as careful, dandified, as some would have said, about his clothing as Jeffrey Halliburton usually was. He wore an old smoking jacket with a belt askew, an open-throated white shirt, and a pair of rough serge pants that would have looked more at home upon the legs of an itinerant gardener than upon those of the richest man in Little Dunthorpe. On his feet were a pair of threadbare slippers. Mrs. Ramage, hardly dressed for a court ball herself, in her long white nightgown and muskrat's nightcap, with the untied curling ribbons hanging around her face like the fringe on a lampshade, stared at him with mounting concern. He had re-injured the ribs he had broken riding after the doctor 3 nights ago. That was obvious. But it wasn't just pain that made his eyes blaze from his whitened face like that. It was terror, barely held in check.
"Mr. Jeffrey! What?"
"No questions," he said hoarsely.
"Not yet. Not until you answer one question of my own." "What question?"
She was badly frightened now, her left hand clenched into a tight fist just above her munificent bosom.
"Does the name Miss Evelyn Hyde mean anything to you?"
And suddenly she knew the reason for that terrible thundery feeling that had been inside her ever since Saturday night. Some part of her mind must already have had this gruesome thought and suppressed it, for she needed no explanation at all. Only the name of the unfortunate Miss Charlotte Evelyn Hyde, late of Storping on Firkill, the village just to the west of Little Dunthorpe, was sufficient to bring a scream tearing from her.
"Oh, my saints! Oh, my dear Jesus! Has she been buried alive? Has she been buried alive? Has my darling Misery been buried alive?"
And now, before Jeffrey could even begin to answer, it was tough old Mrs. Ramage's turn to do something she had never done before that night, and would never do again. She fainted, dead away. Chapter 5. Jeffrey had no time to look for smelling salts. He doubted if a tough old soldier as Mrs. Ramage kept them around anyway. But beneath her sink he found a rag which smelled faintly of ammonia. He did not just pass this beneath her nose, but pressed it briefly against her lower face. The possibility Coulter had raised, however faint, was too hideous to merit much in the way of consideration. She jerked, cried out, and opened her eyes. For a moment she looked at him with dazed, uncomprehending bewilderment. Then she sat up.
"No," she said. "No, Mr. Jeffrey. Say you don't mean it. Say it isn't true."
"I don't know if it's true or not," he said. "But we must satisfy ourselves immediately. Immediately, Mrs. Ramage. I can't do all the digging myself, and if there's digging that must be done..." She was staring at him with horrified eyes. Her hands pressed so tightly over her mouth that the nails were white.
"Can you help me if help is needed? There's really no one else."
"My lord," she said numbly.
"My lord, Mr. Ian..."
"Must know nothing of this until we know more," he said. "If God is good, he need never know at all." He would not voice to her the unspoken hope at the back of his mind, a hope which seemed to him almost as monstrous as his fears. If God was very good, he would find out about this night's work, when his wife and only love was restored to him, her return from the dead almost as miraculous as that of Lazarus.
"Oh, this is terrible, terrible," she said in a faint, fluttery voice.
Holding onto the table, she managed to pull herself to her feet. She stood, swaying, little straggles of hair hanging around her face among the muskrat tails of her cap. "Are you well enough?" he asked, more kindly. "If not, then I must carry on as best I can by myself." She drew a deep, shuddering breath and let it out. The side-to-side sway stopped. She turned and walked toward the pantry. "There's a pair of spades in the shed out back," she said. "A pick as well, I think. Throw them in your trap. And there's half a bottle of gin out here in the pantry. Been here untouched since Bill died 5 years ago on Lammas night. I'll have a bit and then I'll join you, Mr. Jeffrey. You're a brave woman, Mrs. Ramage. Be quick." "Aye, never fear me," she said, and grasped the bottle of gin with a hand that trembled only slightly. There was no dust on the bottle. Not even the pantry was safe from the relentless dust cloud of Mrs. Ramage. But the label reading Clough and Poor Boozers was yellow. "Be quick yourself." She had always hated spirits, and her stomach wanted to sick the gin with its nasty junipery smell and oily taste back up. She made it stay down. Tonight, she would need it. Chapter 6. Under clouds that still raced east to west, blacker shapes against a black sky, and a moon that was now settling toward the horizon, the pony trap sped toward the churchyard. It was now Mrs. Ramage who drove, cracking the whip over the bewildered Mary, who would have told them, if horses could talk, that this was all wrong, that she was supposed to be dozing in her warm stall come this time of night. The spades and the pick chattered coldly one against the other, and Mrs. Ramage thought they would have given anyone who had seen them a proper fright. They must look like a pair of Mr. Dickens' resurrection men, or perhaps one resurrection man sitting in a pony trap driven by a ghost. For she was all in white, had not even paused long enough to gather up her robe. Her nightgown fluttered around her stout, vein-puffed ankles, and the tails of her cap streamed wildly out behind her. Here was the church. She turned Mary up the lane which ran beside it, shivering at the ghostly sound the wind played along the eaves. She had a moment to wonder why such a holy place as a church should seem so frightening after dark, and then realized it was not the church. It was the errand. Her first thought upon coming out of her faint was that my lord must help them. Hadn't he been there in all things, through thick and thin, never wavering? A moment later she realized how mad the idea was. This was not a matter of my lord's courage, but of his very sanity. She hadn't needed Mr. Jeffrey to tell her so. The memory of Miss Evelyn Hyde had done that. She realized that neither Mr. Jeffrey nor my lord had been in Little Dunthorpe when it happened. This had been almost half a year ago in the spring. Misery had entered the rosy summer of her pregnancy, morning sickness behind her, the final rising of her belly and its attendant discomfort still ahead, and she had cheerfully sent the two men off for a week of grouse shooting and card playing and footballing and heaven alone knew what other masculine foolishness at Oak Hall in Doncaster. My lord had been a bit doubtful, but Misery assured him she would be fine, and nearly pushed him out the door. That Misery would be fine, Mrs. Ramage had no doubt. But whenever my lord and Mr. Jeffrey left for Doncaster, she wondered if one of them, or perhaps both, might not return on the back of a cart, toes up. Oak Hall was the inheritance of Albert Fossington, a schoolmate of Jeffrey's and Ian's. Mrs. Ramage quite rightly believed that Bertie Fossington was mad. Some 3 years ago he had eaten his favorite polo pony, after it had broken two legs and needed to be destroyed. It was a gesture of affection, he said. "Learned it from the Fuzzy Wuzzies in Cape Town," he said. "Greek was. Wonderful chaps. Put sticks and things in their smooches, what? Some of them looked like they could carry all 12 volumes of the Royal Navigation Charts on the lower lip, ha-ha. Taught me that each man must eat the thing he loves. Rather poetic in a grisly sort of way, what?" In spite of such bizarre behavior, Mr. Jeffrey and my lord retained a great affection for Bertie. I wonder if that means they'll have to eat him when he's dead. Mrs. Ramage had once wondered after a visit from Bertie, during which he had tried to play croquet with one of the house cats, quite shattering its poor little head, and they had spent nearly 10 days at Oak Hall this past spring. Not more than a day or two after they left, Miss Charlotte Evelyn Hyde of Storping on Firkill had been found dead on the back lawn of her home, Cove of Birches. There had been a freshly picked bunch of flowers near one outstretched hand. The village doctor was a man named Bilford, a capable man by all accounts. Nevertheless, he had called old Dr. Shinebone in to consult. Bilford had diagnosed the fatal malady as a heart attack, although the girl was very young, only 18, and had seemed in the pink of health. Bilford was puzzled. Something seemed not at all right. Old Shinny had been clearly puzzled as well, but in the end he had concurred with a diagnosis. So did most of the village, for that matter. The girl's heart had not been properly made, that was all. Such things were rare, but everyone could recall such a sad case at one time or another. It was probably this universal concurrence that had saved Bilford's practice, if not his head, following the ghastly denouement. Although everyone had agreed that the girl's death was puzzling, it had crossed no one's mind that she might not be dead at all. 4 days following the interment, an elderly woman named Mrs. Soames, Mrs. Ramage knew her slightly, had observed something white lying on the ground of the Congregational Church's cemetery as she entered it to put flowers on the grave of her husband, who had died the previous winter. It was much too big to be a flower petal, and she thought it might be a dead bird of some sort. As she approached, she became more and more sure that the white object was not just lying on the ground, but protruding from it. She came 2 or 3 hesitant steps closer yet, and observed a hand reaching from the earth of a fresh grave, the fingers frozen in a hideous gesture of supplication. Blood-streaked bones protruded from the ends of all the digits, save the thumb. Mrs. Soames ran shrieking from the cemetery, ran all the way into Storping's High Street, a run of nearly 1.25 miles, and reported her news to the barber, who was also the local constable. Then she had collapsed in a dead faint. She took to her bed later that afternoon and did not arise from it for nearly 1 month, nor did anyone in the village blame her in the least. The body of the unfortunate Miss Evelyn Hyde had been exhumed, of course, and as Geoffrey Alliburton drew Mary to a halt in front of the gate leading into Little Dunthorpe C of E churchyard, Mrs. Ramage found herself wishing fervently that she had not listened to the tales of the exhumation. They had been dreadful. Dr. Bilford, shaken to within 1 inch of sanity himself, diagnosed catalepsy. The poor woman had apparently fallen into some sort of death-like trance, much like the sort those Indian fakers could voluntarily induce in themselves before allowing themselves to be buried alive, or to have needles passed through their flesh. She had remained in this trance for perhaps 48 hours, perhaps 60. Long enough, at any rate, to have awakened not to find herself on her back lawn where she had been picking flowers, but buried alive in her own coffin. She had fought grimly for her life, that girl, and Mrs. Ramage found now, following Geoffrey through the gates and into a thin mist that turned the leaning grave markers into islands, that what should have redeemed with nobility only made it seem all the more horrid. The girl had been engaged to be married. In her left hand, not the one frozen above the soil like the hand of a drowned woman, had been her diamond engagement ring. With it she had slit the satin lining of her coffin, and over God knew how many hours she had used it to claw away at the coffin's wooden lid. In the end, air running out, she had apparently used the ring with her left hand to cut and excavate, and her right hand to dig. It had not been quite enough. Her complexion had been a deep purple from which her blood-rimmed eyes stared in a bulging expression of terminal horror. The clock in the church tower began to chime the hour of 12, the hour when, her mother had told her, the door between life and death sways open a bit, and the dead may pass both ways. And it was all Mrs. Ramage could do to keep herself from shrieking and fleeing in a panic, which would not abate, but grow stronger with each step. And if she began running, she knew, she would simply run until she fell down insensible. "Stupid, fearful woman," she berated herself, and then amended that to, "stupid, fearful, selfish woman. It's my lord you want to be thinking of now, not your own fears. My lord, and if there is even one chance that my lady—" Ah, but no. It was madness to even think of such a thing. It had been too long. Too long. Too long. Geoffrey had led her to Misery's tombstone.